Hello, and welcome to the Preoccupied Coronavirus Special.
Seems like every day our inboxes, our news feeds are flooded with information from public officials and researchers about the latest state of the coronavirus. And I'm sure what you're all thinking is, why has Preoccupied been so quiet about this? So today we're talking to Ms. Seifert, a school psychologist, about the way that the coronavirus has impacted the school system and students.
Yeah, and first we're just going to give a little bit of an intro and some background on the coronavirus, how it's been affecting psychology, and then what psychology has had to say about it. So just to give a brief word of background on sort of what we're talking about, I think Governor Gretchen Whitmer of the state of Michigan, where Maddie and I are at, said it best in her executive orders with regard to coronavirus. All of them have started the same way, saying that the novel coronavirus is a respiratory disease that can result in serious illness or death. It is caused by a new strain of coronavirus not previously identified in humans and easily spread from person to person. There is currently no approved vaccine or antiviral treatment for this disease. And that sort of sums up what the United States and really the world has been going through for the last 4 or 5 months or so. Yeah, since this first hit towards the end of December in Wuhan, China.
So over here in Michigan, we are currently going through a very tight stay-at-home order. And what that means is pretty much just limiting contact with the outside world, outside of our homes as much as possible, be that, you know, only leaving your house to get groceries or if you're a caretaker, in order to try to slow the spread of the virus.
Yeah, so that means that universities are closed, businesses are closed. Just about everything has come to a halt that isn't directly supporting the ability to sustain life, right? So that has things like podcast recordings also having been moved virtually as Maddie and I speak over Zoom right now, recording on our own separate computers. So enough about the circumstances of this pandemic, as I'm sure everyone listening is familiar enough with. Let's start talking about some of the interesting things. How has the field of psychology approached this pandemic? In recent weeks, psychologists have been applying a lot of research that had previously been conducted about how people respond to disease and to mass trauma in general to figure out how people can best cope with this coronavirus.
So you may find some of the things that we mentioned today consistent with the patterns that you see in your own life or in the media.
One theory that's been especially applicable comes out of evolutionary psychology, and that's the theory of the behavioral immune system. So just as we evolved a physiological immune system to actively attack pathogens that enter our body, we also evolved a sort of behavioral immune system that serves to prevent us from getting infected with these pathogens in the first place. So one element of this behavioral immune system is the emotion of disgust. And that's something that evolved to come up when we see things that may be a vector for disease.
So for example, we might avoid other people's bodily fluids like vomit and the like, because that's a really great carrier for diseases. So our behavioral immune system automatically reacts to those sorts of things in a way that will make us more likely to try to avoid those things as much as possible.
Yeah. And we're not conscious of the reasoning behind this, right? Because these behaviors were just selected for. All we know is that there's this emotion that we experience that makes us averse to these things that we feel disgust toward. So other than things that are just disgusting because they arise from bodily processes, the behavioral immune system has extended this emotion of disgust to also apply to human behavior.
When people are reminded of the threat of disease, they are more likely to be more judgmental towards people who may be deviating from the norm. Once we knew that some behaviors help to combat disease more than others, for example, hand washing, these became a part of the social norm. In one experiment, there were two groups of participants. One group was reminded to wash their hands. The other one wasn't. Both groups were given a scenario in which somebody was engaging in some sort of deviant or abnormal behavior. The hand washers responded in a more judgmental way than the non-hand washers. And we believe that this is because the threat of disease created that sort of vigilance for people who go against the norm.
And that can be helpful in times of pandemic or just threat of disease in general, when that judgment results in harsher treatment of people who don't follow certain societal conventions that do help prevent the spread of disease, such as hand washing and clean preparation of food. And
this kind of leads us to our next concept, which is when people are under the threat of disease, there's a greater fear of outsiders, of the unknown.
And this makes sense, right? Because when you see disease floating around, the last thing that you need to be doing is interacting with people who are from outside your group. Because the more that a group isolates itself against the outside, the less likely it is that the pathogen's going to infiltrate and sort of infect that whole group. Now, in modern society, that leads to all sorts of problems, such as we've been hearing about increased incidence of prejudice and hate crimes and such against people of Asian descent, stemming from all the media coverage about China's handling of the coronavirus.
Something else that plays into this fear of outsiders is that the threat of disease makes us feel vulnerable. And studies show that when we feel vulnerable, we're more likely to make more negative first impressions of people that we meet.
So all of this just goes to show how the brain and the behaviors that people engage in have evolved over time to better be able to address emergent threats like disease.
So while these behavioral immune system mechanisms might make us more judgmental, make us quicker to assume the worst, at their core they exist in order to help us combat disease in an effective way. So it is important that we wash our hands, that our friends wash their hands for when we do our awesome super secret handshakes once this is all over. But it's important to keep in mind that these mechanisms exist in all of us in a very, very real way. So to be aware of that as you're meeting new people through your Zoom conferences and after the pandemic and we're trying to get back to normal, that these things exist.
Another thing that has been a significant part of daily discourse in the United States has been talking about how best to handle the coronavirus on a governmental level. And especially in the state of Michigan, we've seen a lot of division over what course of action is best to both preserve the health and safety of the people in the state and ensure that the economy remains strong enough that people have enough in the way of resources to be able to continue to live, right? And as with most disagreements, a lot of these positions have largely fallen along party lines. People who identify as conservative tend to be in favor of reopening things and stimulating the economy, whereas people who identify as more liberal tend to be more in favor of keeping people quarantined in order to prevent the spread of the virus. What's confusing the field of psychology is that these are not the positions that would be predicted by past research. Especially with past crises like the war on drugs and 9/11, Republican politicians have been seen to be especially reactive to these crises and wanting to do everything possible to prevent further negative effects. With this coronavirus, we're seeing sort of the opposite effect play out. So some researchers from the University of Montana set out to survey people and figure out what factors were influencing what they thought should be done about the coronavirus. And they asked about all sorts of things, including how threatening they thought the virus was, how much they had been personally affected by the virus and how it had affected people around them, and then what political outcomes they wanted to see with regard to the virus. So things like the government enforcing social distancing and the wearing of masks, things like stay-home orders. And what they found was that how threatening someone thought the virus was had nothing to do with what they thought should be done about it, nor did how much the virus was affecting them or the people around them. It was predicted mainly just by their political beliefs. So if someone identified as conservative, then they tended to think that it would be a great idea to reopen. And if people were liberal, they thought it would be a great idea to continue lockdown indefinitely. So that's another thing to keep in mind, especially when you're having conversations with maybe relatives or friends with whom you disagree about this. A lot of what we believe with regard to this virus isn't really a direct result of how we think about it or how it's been affecting us. In that sense, it's not personal. It's more to do with these evolved reactions that we have to disease and to pandemic, where we strengthen our group associations and tend to follow with whatever we're being told by the people that we trust.
So as we adjust to this new normal, a lot of our institutions look a lot different than what we're used to. And one of the institutions that is undergoing rapid change in response to the pandemic is the school system. So Zenon and I were curious about that, so we called up our old friend Mrs. Seifert, the school psychologist, to talk to her about how a school day looks different and how students can have their needs met during this pandemic.
And with that, we go to our second interview with Mrs. Krista Seifert.
So how have your responsibilities as a school psychologist changed since the pandemic began?
Well, a lot of what we would traditionally do within the school setting is not able to be done virtually. For example, testing is a huge part of what a school psychologist does, and we don't have the capacity to test because there's no one on the other side to facilitate some of the things that we use with testing. So that's been stopped. Some of the school psychologists who have the opportunity to have more of a social emotional support role within their buildings have been involved in doing groups via Google Meet, which is the platform my district uses. But really, we're more of just a support to whoever needs us, whether it be teachers, parents, and then through IEP meetings, showing up there to offer support. It's basically what our role is at this point. So we're still like kind of shaping what our role is and then what it could be if we continue to work virtually in the fall.
So how are students at tiers 2 and 3 being helped while schools aren't meeting in person?
That is so tough because right now schools are teaching, but we're not monitoring like we would typically do within a school setting just because we don't have that capacity built at this point. So right now we don't have a systematic way to like screen all students or to monitor the progress of all students academically or behaviorally. So we're just relying on teacher reports. So if a family reports they have a need or something, a student reports something, then we funnel it through different channels to get the student and the family support that they need. In some cases, we will identify students in need of support just because they're not showing up. So we have a no contact list at each building. So if there is a student or a family that we haven't heard from, despite us reaching out to them, our whole message is to assume positive intent because we don't know what's going on their side. So we want to be there as a support to help them through whatever it is. Maybe they can't engage in learning at this time, but maybe they have other needs that we can support them with. So we are just funneling it through kind of the old school referral model and then monitoring what we can based on students who aren't engaged.
So it sounds like despite not being able to be in that physical space like you might usually be used to, you're able to find other ways to supplement looking out for students.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really more indirect service delivery, and it's more hands-off, obviously, because we may not ever get in touch with these families, but we're doing what we can. Mm-hmm. So we're learning day by day what we can do and how our role can evolve and change so we can be supportive to whoever needs it.
How do you think this less structured time could hold consequences, good or bad, for students as they advance through their academic career from this point?
Well, it's teaching students to be structured and how to approach tasks. They're either going to sink or swim. So students are figuring out how to structure their days with some modeling and support from teachers, but it's on them to log in and pull up assignments and turn assignments in that are completed. So it really is teaching students to take initiative. And if they don't, then there would be some consequences for that. So it's really putting some of that onto students, and it's up to them to figure out how to do it. Some students have support from their families with doing these things. Other students don't have support. Some students are doing really well with this. Other students who are able to be with their families throughout the day are getting a lot more like family time. So that's a positive. Even if it's not them directly doing all the learning, they're still spending a lot more time with their families than they typically would. So I think that's a big positive for many of our students who don't have a lot of time with their families. A downside of this unstructured time is that students who don't have initiative and don't have that support may not be gaining as much from the instruction as other peers might be. Also, students who are in need of intervention and remediation may not be getting the level of support that they need at this time, and that may cause them to fall further and further behind. So I think there are some positives, but there are also some negatives with the current virtual learning that is happening. And if we continue to be in a virtual environment, then those are things that we'll have to figure out how to address.
Definitely. Yeah. So it sounds like there's a lot going on now that's sort of informing how everyone is thinking about how to change things for maybe a more long-term plan going forward.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So then kind of going off that, do you think that this pandemic is going to have a lasting impact on the public education system and the people who work in it?
I think so, financially.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that teachers are not laid off and support staff aren't laid off because of funding issues. But that is a real possible consequence to this situation. Other things are, we might learn that virtual learning is really impactful with some students, and maybe this is something that we want to do more of. One thing that I've noticed with teachers is that they can record lessons, and then if it's some students aren't able to log on at that time when the teacher presents the lesson, then they can make that lesson available to the students so they can access it at different times. And I think that's a good form of direct instruction, allowing students who learn at different rates to access this virtual learning so that they can go at their own pace. And I think this is something we need to do more of. And I think maybe virtual learning will help teachers see that this is something quite easy to do and an easy way to support students who may need more repetition. And the teacher doesn't have time to sit with them one-on-one, but they can record something, a simple instruction of how to do a multi-step problem, and the student can play it back as much as they need to. So I'm hoping that's something we can walk away from here, is knowing how to differentiate a little bit more for students who learn differently. But overall, other than virtual learning, I think we're learning that teachers are more valuable than some people give them credit for. I know parents are showing a lot more gratitude towards teachers and educators, and I think that's significant. Because a lot of times parents can feel like what teachers do isn't really meaningful or impactful, or they could do better, or you really don't understand my kid. But now with parents having their kids at home and they're teaching them or facilitating getting them onto the learning platform, they're seeing just how challenging teaching can be and how you do have to differentiate and how students have different barriers to learning, and teachers know how to work with those things. So I think there might be more of an appreciation for educators, hopefully. So I'm hoping that a lot of positives come out of this. And at the end of the day, also, I think testing companies will be working on how to create assessments that can be done virtually. So that's something that I'm also looking forward to seeing in the future. So I'm trying to focus on the positives, trying to think about the good outcomes from this, because that's what's going to keep pushing us through, right?
Thank you so much again to Mrs. Seifert for talking with us about how your role has changed and how our school systems can anticipate changing over the next couple of months. Now, before we let you go, we thought we would talk about how this pandemic is affecting our mental health on a personal level and what you can do to thrive even while you're staying home and staying safe.
Yeah, so one mental health element that's being affected in a really significant way by this pandemic is loneliness. And that makes sense, right? As everyone's being forced to stay home, everyone is also going to be having less social interaction as your workplaces and schools and whatnot are closed. And loneliness is an issue that psychology has been researching since before this pandemic, especially as we're looking at different generations and how everyone sort of feels disconnected from everyone else. And especially as we progress into the modern age, a lot of people feel like they have a lot of very shallow connections, but not really a lot of meaningful interpersonal connection with each other. So it's especially important during this crisis to maintain contact with those who are important to you, be that friends, loved ones, coworkers, classmates, whoever it is that you would normally be in contact with is a good opportunity to find someone who may also need someone to talk to during this time.
So one way to reach out to your loved ones, if you're not really into the snail mail thing, would be through video conferencing and phone calls, of course. So something that has just catapulted in popularity the past few months is Zoom and other video conferencing things like it, like Skype, Google Hangouts, Google Meets, all of those sorts of things. And this is pretty cool because something that, you know, things like FaceTime does give you is that context of facial expression and body language that you might be missing out on if you are talking over the phone. But it also has its drawbacks. This facial expression and body language that you are receiving is pixelated. And there's something lost there when we're understanding one another's facial expressions. Along with that, expressions and even just responding is often delayed, and not having that immediate feedback can leave people feeling kind of uneasy. And then another thing that kind of plays into this uneasiness feeling is that, you know how when you're in a Zoom call, you're looking at somebody in their face, but you're not really making eye contact. And eye contact is something that is so important for trust and feeling that safety, that sometimes people will be done with a day full of video conferencing and just feel exhausted or on edge.
Yeah, and one more factor that's at play in video calls is, like we talked about when we interviewed Dr. Sexton a while back, is mirroring, right? So when we're talking to each other in person, we often mimic a lot of the facial expressions that the person we're talking with is making to show that we get what they're saying and that we empathize with them, right? As all people do with each other. And that is very difficult over a video call where you have things are pixelated, of course. When connection is poor, you have maybe the video even cuts out entirely and freezes, or you see like blocking or blurring or other video artifacts going on. And even if everything does come across smoothly, there's still that delay, right? And all of that prevents this really integral social process from occurring over a video call. So that's why some people have gone so far as to suggest that it's good to mix things up sometimes. And instead of using Zoom or video or FaceTime or Google Duo or whatever your preferred video chat is all the time, that it may be good to use a phone call. Because using a phone call has some unique benefits, especially as we're upgrading our wireless networks and whatnot. The audio quality over a phone call is often much higher than it is over a video call, because the bandwidth is available to dedicate just to that audio stream, and it's not being distracted by trying to send an image across. Another benefit is that a lot of us are likely more familiar with the experience of a phone call than we are with a video call. And we've already learned to associate connection with having someone's voice right up next to our ear, like we do when we're on a phone call, than what we do on a video call, where it's a bit less personal and all we're hearing is maybe a staticky, compressed, broken up audio stream from a phone speaker a couple feet away.
So if you're missing that emotional intimacy or the... So if you feel like you're missing out on that emotional intimacy or that camaraderie that you felt in your day-to-day life, going to school, going to work, pick up the phone and try to keep a nice, healthy balance of the video calls with the audio calls. As I'm sure your Facebook feed has informed you, something else that people are doing to combat loneliness during this pandemic is to get a puppy.
And this is a phenomenon that's been observed all sorts of places and has even been talked about a bit by the academic community, leading to the term pandemic puppy. And Maddie, word has it that you've taken part in this trend yourself and obtained a small canine of your own. You want to tell us a bit about that?
Thank you for asking, Zenon. I know it's everybody is wondering. His name is Goose. He's a sheepdog mix, and he's an angel. And, you know, it's definitely been nice to have something to focus on besides the impending doom of the universe or whatever. And my biggest concern when I wake up is to let the puppy out and hopefully not get piss on my carpet is definitely more welcome than an existential crisis or, oh, my online classes have homework due and so on and so forth. So I would definitely recommend it if your shelter still has puppies to take in.
Yeah, definitely. And fostering animal connection too is a great way to be able to get some physical contact in with someone that you love, right? While maybe you're unable to reach family or loved ones.
Right. I'm pretty sure that petting animals like has some sort of calming effect even down to like the physiological level.
Oh, I'm sure there's plenty of research out about that. Yeah. One thing that you can still do even under stay home orders is go out and get some physical activity. You can go for a walk, bike ride, a run. A lot of parks are still open. I know in Michigan, we even have the metro parks that are usually like paid admission are free 3 days of the week so that people can come out and still get exposure to the outdoors during this pandemic. And like we talked about a few episodes ago with Scott Greenspan, right? Exercise is a very important element of maintaining mental health. So especially if you're feeling kind of locked in, cooped up, like you just have some physical energy that needs expending, go take a walk. 20 minutes a day is all it really takes, and the movement, the fresh air, is really going to help increase the quality of your socially distanced life.
And you know what? If you're bored, you're so welcome that Preoccupied is here with, what, 14 episodes of content to entertain you on your 20-minute walks. And as the Domino's commercials will remind you, we are all in this together. And while you might be sick of those kinds of commercials, it's a very real principle, this idea of unity from a shared hardship. And this is a hardship that we're sharing all over the world.
Yeah, and one thing that psychology has found with regard to response to hardship is that especially when a threat doesn't have an apparent personal source, instead of the fight, flight, or freeze response that you hear about, that tends to come on when maybe, say, there's a tiger chasing you, right? And you can see this present personal threat of, there is a tiger that is chasing me. One response that we see a lot when there's a less personal threat, maybe that evolved during times of hunger or hardship in that sense, is tend and befriend. And that's what we see with this coronavirus starting to come up a lot, is that in response to this crisis, our physiology gets flooded with oxytocin and other neurotransmitters that lead us to seek others out and try and support each other the best we can. So maybe this will even teach our society how to be better. Maybe this crisis is going to have the end result of showing us that we can show each other empathy and that we can cooperate, not just as political parties or as countries, but as a species.
So while you are catching up on all of the archives of episodes that we have, make sure that you subscribe, rate, review, like us on Facebook, Instagram, all of that stuff, Twitter, and send us an email about what you would like to see, about what you thought of our latest episodes. Be in touch with us at hosts@pre-occupied.com.
Yep, and you can go to that website too, pre-occupied.com, to see an archive of all sorts of old episodes sorted by area of interest, and also to get links to the podcast on whatever your favorite platform may be.
Thank you so much for listening, and remember to stay home, stay safe, but also stay connected, stay active, and stay kind.
And we will see you next time on Pre-Occupied.